the best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, let's face it, academic writing can be boring. We'll speak with author Leonard Casuto about his book, Academic Writing as If Readers Matter.
If the solution is, how do you communicate? The answer is, you communicate by thinking about that person on the other end.
And we'll catch up with a pair of college presidents. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Academic writing can be dull. Leonard Casuto wants to change that. Casuto is a professor of English at Fordham University and a regular columnist for the Chronicle of Higher Education. His latest book, Academic Writing as If Readers Matter, wants to make anyone, even you, a better writer. The book serves as a how-to guide to sharpen writing while weaving in examples of effective and non-effective writing, and some humor, too. I spoke with Casuto to learn more.
There are a lot of reasons that I wrote this book, but one of them, maybe the most important one, is that I have read too much academic writing that I had to trudge through. That was just sheer hard work to get through. And I thought, what's wrong with academic writing anyway, and how can it be fixed? And the answer, it turns out, is simple to state, but hard to carry out. The problem with academic writing is that it doesn't communicate, by which I mean there's information in it, but the writer is not accepting the responsibility to convey that information to somebody on the other end and create some kind of circuit in which something is exchanged and the world gets bigger. So that's the problem. And if the solution is, how do you communicate? The answer is you communicate by thinking about that person on the other end and trying to meet that person's needs. That part is easier said than done. And that's why the answer took an entire book to communicate.
Do you have an example of when you were reading and you were just bored to tears? It's something that stuck out to you because it was so dull.
Well, frankly, there are a good number of those in the book. But I did try to put examples in the book from a whole range of fields, good ones, of course, as well as bad ones. I don't want to call somebody out by name here because the problem is not with any particular person or any particular academic journal. The problem is cultural, that academic writers, by which I mean any writer who is writing about something serious for an audience, could be an audience of one, academic writers are socialized to write badly. And that's why I say that this is a cultural problem. I describe what I call the primal scene of academic writing in the book. And the primal scene is simply some student writing some paper for some teacher someplace, which, if you are a student, is you recognize as a scene that you repeat many times. And as you repeat it, it becomes obviously more familiar each time. And you lose perhaps some of the distinguishing features of that scene. The most distinct feature of that scene, it seems to me, and one of the easiest to overlook, is that the reader is being paid to read it. That a teacher who is assigning a paper to a student and then reading what comes in is getting paid. And so the writer soon gets used to the idea that you don't have to worry about losing the attention of this reader, because it's already been bought and paid for.
In the book, you point out writing with the reader in mind. And for myself, working in radio, we always hear about you're writing for the ear. You know, you want to write directly. You can't ramble on with your sentences like maybe I'm doing right now. But can you give an example of what it means to you to write with the reader in mind and have respect for the reader when you're putting pen to paper?
If you're an academic writer, and we will distinguish that from the example you just gave of writing for the ear for the radio, because writing that's for somebody who's listening is quite a bit different from writing for somebody who's reading. If you were writing in an academic setting, you want to think about who the reader is. Now, I put a lot of whimsical formulations in this book. You can call them jokes if you want. I hope that that if you read this book, they'll make you smile. And one of them is to imagine the academic reader, first of all, as somebody who is reading for use. If I'm a student who is researching a paper I'm going to write, then I'm going to do that research. I'm not going to put it down because because I don't like the style. So I'm reading for my job, for use. Now, in the book, I compare this to the idea of the reader as a blue whale. So the academic reader is a kind of blue whale. The blue whale spends its days taking giant gulps of water and then forcing that water through the baleen in its mouth, which acts as a strainer or a sieve, which forces the water out and saves the food, which in the case of a blue whale is krill, a form of plankton. So if I'm an academic writer and I'm writing for a reader who is reading for use, I need to keep that reader's habits in mind. And I can succeed better with that reader if I understand that reader's needs, which will include, for example, front-loading the description of what it is that I'm doing, because an academic reader is looking for that. They want to see what's in this piece, and then they may need to go to the part that matters to them. And that's not something that should offend me as a writer. I should be grateful that there's something in there that the reader wants. But what I'm fundamentally trying to do is be friendly to that reader.
Do you think that bad habits in academic writing are related to, maybe not maliciously, but to ego in some way, that the folks who are writing to publish maybe something they've been working on for years, they're so wrapped up in the research that they can't spare any detail, that they think everything is important? Do you think that is contributing to boring academic writing?
That is one of the aspects, certainly, the desire to show everything that you read. I had a teacher once who said, you should write your first book with lots of footnotes so that you can write your next books without any footnotes. Well, I've read a lot of academic writing that suggests that there are too many academic writers, starting again with students, who want to show everything that they read because they're insecure about their expertise. Now, there is a place for the demonstration of expertise. If I'm going to pick something up and try to learn from it, I want to know that the person who wrote it knows something of what they're talking about, certainly. But I don't need to have a Christmas tree full of ornaments that demonstrate that the writer has read every possible thing out there. It's enough that I should see it. And here I can draw on Ernest Hemingway, who very famously in advice to fiction writers said that you should think of your writing as an iceberg. 10% of it is above the waterline. That's the part that the reader sees. But if you do your job correctly, then the reader is going to understand the 90% that they don't see.
I'm also reminded of Mark Twain when he said, I didn't have time to write a short letter, so I wrote a long one instead.
Yes, he was paraphrasing the French philosopher Pascal.
You bring up the point of what you call creative rule breaking. Can you tell me a little bit more about what it means to break convention? And how to, have fun with the structure of things sometimes.
Certainly. Let's start with the idea of what convention is. Convention is a set of agreed upon rules that are within a community. We agree, for example, that if we are writing a letter, that we begin with a salutation. Dear Lucas, or hi, Lucas, or something like that. If I omit that salutation, there might be some trouble. There may be some misunderstanding that results. That's a simple example of convention. Another convention is that if you're starting a new thought, you begin a new paragraph. So I don't want to belabor this. Convention is simply what we agree upon as the rules that govern the communication of meaning. Now, something that I try to be clear about in the book is that you need to know the rules. However, if you're a slave to those rules, then your writing is going to become mechanical and boring. So knowing the rules means also knowing when it's a good idea to break them, knowing when a run-on sentence might make sense, knowing when a one-sentence paragraph is something that your writing needs in order to allow the thing that you're saying in that very short paragraph to go zing, come to bounce right out and make the reader see it. But if you do all of your paragraphs as one sentence, then you will be assumed to have made a mistake and not a point. So if you want to be seen as somebody who is breaking the rules because they know them, you have to show that you can follow them in the other spaces to work within the conventions that we share as writers and readers.
So, when you look to the future, do you have hope that writers, academic writers specifically, will turn things around a little bit? You know, we hear a lot about how the norms of higher education are changing in a lot of ways and how students are maybe not looking for a traditional 4-year college after high school anymore. Do you think that academic writing will change on the larger scale? Or that it has to change to capture readers' attention.
I think it has to because it had better, and so it had better. I'm trying to be optimistic about this. I'm a reformer. I'm not a revolutionary. I don't want to blow it up. I want to change it. And I think that if academic writing doesn't acknowledge the need to communicate, then we as academics are contributing to our own withdrawal from a public sphere that badly needs us.
Leonard Casuto is an English professor at Fordham University and author of Academic Writing as If Readers Matter, published by Princeton University Press. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. David Harris, the president of Union College in Schenectady, New York, will leave his position at the end of the academic year. Harris, who previously served as provost and senior vice president at Tufts University, said his time at Union would be his last college presidency. The college says it will conduct a national search for its next leader. Harris tells me the length of a college president's tenure is getting shorter.
I think the first thing that people have to, it's helpful to appreciate is the context, sort of how long do presidents serve? It's easy in the U.S., you get two 4-year terms. But college presidents, people might think, well, you know, yeah, Dr. Jackson, RPI was like 22 years. You've seen some others over 10. But things have really changed in the last 10, 20 years. So, for example, the president of Hamilton College was 8. He just left. You've got 8 years at RPI. Franklin and Marshall just announced she's 7. So 7 years is actually longer than the average college president. So that's just the context. As far as me and specifically, what I'm focused on is Union long term and asking the question, when should I give notice so that I'm sure I've got a year where I'm running as hard as possible to make sure that it's a good pass off to the next person? And just thought about everything we've been doing and said, you know, I think this is the right time.
So, have you given any thought to your next move yet, or is that a little too far down the line to make those decisions right now?
So I think for me, it's more what I'm not doing than what I am. So I'm not looking for another presidency. If I were, this is the time I'd be doing it. And I'm pretty clear and have been for quite a while that this is my college presidency at Union. I love Union, love what we're doing here. And beyond that, I'm not sure. We have a lot of work to do this year, and that's really my focus. And in the background, I'll think about what next, but part of it is just sort of, you know, recharging afterwards and then thinking about it and doing something else.
So, in your time at Union, it's safe to say that things were a bit challenging. The COVID-19 pandemic, most notably. What can you tell me about your time navigating Union through COVID? And what did you take from maybe your experience at Tufts into that challenge? What did you have to relearn entirely?
Yeah, so it's funny. At my inaugural address, I said that it's unwise to give a firm plan for your presidency because you don't know what's coming. And boy, did I not know what was coming. So COVID, I feel lucky that I was already on the job for year and a half or so before it hit. So I already had built some connections, which was critically important, to telling folks with short notice, everybody go, and then stay away, and then people trusting me that we had the safety procedures in place to bring folks back in the fall, which was a huge decision. So I just loved it here at Union. I felt like part of what we learned was that we can do things we don't think we can do. I sort of often compared it to the community of, I ran the Boston Marathon twice, and I didn't think I could run the Boston Marathon ever. But once you've done something like that, you're like, you know what? We can push and beyond into what's comfortable, into the uncomfortable, and thrive. And I think we've used that as we've created new majors at Union, as we've created this new hockey rink partnership and exceed our capital campaign goals, you know, gone through last year after October 7th, the challenges that plagued many schools afterwards. So that's some of what we learned.
So the college credits you with building connections and helping the college build connections with the city of Schenectady. Can you tell me a little bit about why you felt it was important for the college to reach out and be collaborative with the municipality during your presidency?
Yeah, so I told my chief of staff, the day I was announced, I said, I need to have one meeting for sure, and that's with Mayor Gary McCarthy in his office. And I just sat down with Gary and I said, look, Union and Schenectady are connected at the hip, and we can't be great if the city's not great and the other way around. If you've ever been to campus, we're right in the middle of Schenectady. So it seems that partnership seems like a no-brainer to me. And so it's gone very well. We have folks who are coming to campus and saying, wow, there's opportunities on J Street, opportunities in Mohawk Harbor. This is nice. You can walk to places. So we've tried to be good partners in that. And again, the rink, which I mentioned a couple times, is a key part of that. It's going to be great for Union adjacent to campus. Also, it should be fantastic for the city.
Yeah, and that's the new ice rink that's going to be down there at Mohawk Harbor, which is a part of the city that has been invested in very heavily, especially over the last decade or so, and is certainly going to be larger and an improvement over the existing facility, though I do love the hockey games at the Ice House on campus.
Yeah, me too. The challenge, just so people are clear, that it's great, but it's not sustainable. There's a lot of mechanical problems that would cost us millions of dollars to fix, so otherwise we'd love to keep playing there.
If you had to look ahead at what challenges the college will have moving forward, is it similar to other colleges and universities around the country, maybe both public and private? Union is a private school, but what do you think is coming in the world of higher education that presidents will have to deal with across the country?
Yeah, I think you need to give me my own radio show to answer that question. It's a big one. But,
well, if you don't have a gig lined up, you can come on, swing by.
There you go. So one of my pet peeves is when we don't appreciate the heterogeneity of higher education. We're so different. You know, Michigan, you know, Texas Tech, Union. There's three schools, radically different schools. But we often talk about higher ed, debt, and so forth. So for a school like Union, a top 50 U.S. News, highly selective liberal arts college, what do we see? Well, one of the challenges is the demographic cliff. There are fewer students going to colleges in general, and that's especially true in the Northeast. At Union College, we've diversified geographically, which is huge, pulling more kids from west of the Mississippi, south of the Mason-Dixon line, and internationally. So that's one thing you're going to see across the country is this demographic cliff. With fewer students going, it's just going to mean you're going to see more schools close, more schools struggle. Secondly, the extremely high cost of higher education, right? Higher than the median family income. What that means is that, again, you're going to see schools under tremendous budget pressure. It's why Union College has already been thinking about how do we bring in financial aid. We brought in my administration tens of millions of dollars in financial aid to offset that for students. A third thing you're going to see is people asking, well, the ROI, like return on investment, like why should I go to college? Again, it's great. Union College is well positioned because you've got the small liberal arts college with the connections to faculty, but you also have the diverse portfolio of offerings, everything from civil and environmental engineering to econ, psychology, philosophy, across the board, English, you're seeing it here at Union College. So that combination is a special sauce. And then you've got Division I athletics, men's and women's ice hockey, the excitement of that in a liberal arts setting, which, again, you don't usually see. So there's a lot of challenges for higher ed. I feel like Union's really well positioned.
Well, do you think that students, maybe current high school students, or maybe people as young as middle school, they may look at what you said, the return on investment, and may say, hey, college isn't for me. Are colleges facing an enthusiasm gap, if you will, with students who are in the graduation pipeline?
I think that's true. But again, that goes back to my point about heterogeneity in higher education. So schools vary in their ROI and what you get out of it, both monetarily as well as preparing for the future. And so, and also they vary tremendously in how much debt you're going to graduate with. Union College, you're going to graduate with less student debt than you probably will have for your first car that you buy, your car loan. That's not true of many schools. So the key for us is to ask, how do we help students really understand what's special about Union and a school like Union, and to help them understand why that's good investment in their future, again, monetarily as well as developmentally, intellectually.
So President Harris, you're looking at your final academic year as a college president at Union.
Yep.
What do you really want to accomplish over the next several months, saying, hey, this is something, we did this, we overcame this challenge?
So for me, I would say my two favorite days of the year are move-in and commencement. There's the excitement, the anticipation of move-in when you meet the families and meet the students. And then there's this incredible honor and privilege I have, which is I'm the first person to shake their hand and say, congratulations, you're a college graduate. And so what I want to do this year is make sure we do everything possible to give these seniors the best possible experience in their final year at Union. That's my short term. Longer term focus is, you know, helping Union, as I've done since I've been here, look at foundational, structural budget challenges, look at what we offer, how we offer it, and make as much progress as we can to set up the next person to say it's a relay race, right? Pass the baton so the next person who carries it for some period of time can help this college continue to thrive over the next 230 years the way it has over the past 230 years.
Union College President David Harris will depart the private institution at the end of this academic year. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Colleges are settling into the new school year after a tense spring marked by student protests over the Israel-Hamas war. At SUNY New Paltz, more than 130 people were arrested in May when New York State Police were called in to break up a pro-Palestine encampment on campus. Nearby Vassar College in Poughkeepsie also saw a multi-day encampment of students, but it was able to reach an agreement to bring the encampment down. Vassar College President Elizabeth Bradley spoke with WAMC Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Jesse King to reflect on what the campus has learned since the spring.
Last May was a complicated time for all of higher education and really the globe with the enormous war with Israel and Hamas. On our campus, students are very engaged. They're taught to be critical thinkers. They're taught to care about big ideas in the world. So, of course, they were engaged with this. As it turns out, ultimately, our campus, I think, was very successful in not having any violence, in students being able to really talk with each other ultimately, and our encampment was removed within about 4 to 5 days of it beginning, which was done through, I think, what's most important at Vassar, which is we really try to work together on things. So I met with the students, understood what they were, you know, trying to express. I wanted them to be successful in expressing themselves. Free speech is so important. Protest is important. It's achieved a lot in our world. But at the same time, we did have the whole community to consider and work to limit the harm to everybody. And ultimately, I think it worked well.
You said you met with the students. Like, what was the sense of, like, what was the message that you were getting from them?
They wanted more attention on what was happening in Gaza. They wanted our campus and I think the globe to pay more attention, to understand what a humanitarian tragedy it has been, and to be politically active.
And tell me about the deal that you ultimately ended up, reaching with students to take down the encampment.
I ultimately would not call it a deal. We really co-created what we thought would be appropriate for our campus. So this involved looking at our curriculum, understanding, do we have all the courses we need in peace and conflict? Are students getting equipped with intellectual tools to use? Are they learning the history of the Middle East? And so now we have a large effort to get students and faculty together to really talk about what kind of curricular innovations there may be. We also have worked hard to attract some faculty who have greater expertise in the area and have them now as visitors. So I think that's really an educational response to what the needs were.
And as students return to campus, you know, what has sort of been the, what has the atmosphere been like?
So we've only been here 2 weeks, and I would say the overwhelming emotion on campus is joyfulness. Students are very excited about seeing each other again after a long summer. We have had some protest, healthy protest, that has not disrupted any of the educational environment, and I think has been respectful. But I obviously the issue still is here.
Vassar College was one of the few who was able to sort of like, able to get the encampment down without having to call in police or anything like that. In terms of what we've seen at other colleges like SUNY New Paltz or down in like the Westchester area, SUNY Purchase, I guess like, is there anything that you would hope colleges take away from these experiences and sort of like how to approach protests going forward?
Well, first, every college is different. The culture is different in every college. The histories are different. The needs are different. So one thing we take away is you just really have to know your campus and manage it in a way that will work for your campus. At Vassar, that meant a close community that's relatively contained, where I know the president knows lots of students, the administration knows lots of students, the faculty are very excited about thinking outside the box. So for us, being able to, you know, our takeaway, which I think might help other colleges, but our takeaway is you got to invest in these relationships before, during, and after. You know, the relationships are what get us through, and they make us a strong learning community. So that's the key.
When it comes to on-campus protests, I think like this has really like promoted this discussion of sort of like how do you balance between protecting students' right to free speech with also, you know, protecting other students' right to feel safe on their campus. You know, where do you view that line, I guess, is where a protest starts to go over the boundary?
Well, as you said, we have to pursue always both free speech and the limit of harm to each other. And if one is creative and committed and understands in a trusting way that's what the whole community has committed to, you can get through it. There are so many creative ways in which people can protest and not harm each other.
Vassar College President Elizabeth Bradley speaking with WAMC's Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Jesse King. By way of disclosure, Vassar College is home to WAMC's Hudson Valley Bureau. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1772. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.